It's 2008, and a man named Judd Apatow has taken over the modern box office. The 1-2 punch of his writer-director efforts, The 40-Year-Old Virgin in 2005 and Knocked Up in 2007, plus the films he produced Anchorman in 2004, Talladega Nights in 2006, Superbad in 2007, Pineapple Express in 2008, Forgetting Sarah Marshall also in 2008, all cemented his status as the new big voice in comedy. Not many directors, writers, producers become the household name that he was back then, and I was all in. I adored these movies. They were some of the foundations of my early DVD collection. I watched them all multiple times. And alongside How I Met Your Mother, they also helped form my ridiculous crush on Jason Segel. Being the huge film and TV nerd that I am, I went online and read through Apatow's career, and discovered his early work included producing a television show called Freaks and Geeks. The cast included many of his now featured players, Segel, of course, but also Seth Rogen and James Franco, arguably some of the biggest stars of the day. But this show was on back in 1999, when many of them were still teenagers, and it seems like no one really saw it. With the newfound success and stardom of these people, the show was being rediscovered, and apparently, it was really flippin' good. The creator was Paul Feig, who I actually already knew as Mr. Poole from Sabrina the Teenage Witch, but in a few years from my Wikipedia searching in 2008, would also make his mark on the modern comedy scene for being the director of Bridesmaids, Spy, A Simple Favour, and the criminally underrated reboot of Ghostbusters starring Kate McKinnon. What was this show that lasted only one season, but featured some of the most talented people in Hollywood? It wasn't too hard to find. This was pre-streaming services, but the entire series had been uploaded to YouTube. I binged it all in just a few days and could not believe what I was seeing. Here was this thoughtful, hilarious, moving, and authentic show about what it was like to be an adolescent, and it was basically ignored when it was on. It rocketed to my top 5 favourite shows and has remained there for the last 15 years. I rewatch it regularly. I show it to my high school classes, particularly the pilot, which I think remains one of the greatest pilots and just episodes of television that exists. Its reputation has only gotten bigger in the years since, even as Apatow is no longer the biggest thing in comedy right now. Though I do ask, what is? Who is? Where's the studio comedy, guys? Get it together. In this episode, I'm going to be diving into the making of this now cult classic and discussing why it remains a genuinely unique and special show. What does a show made in the 90s but set in the 80s still have to say? Turns out, a whole heck of a lot. Now, if you haven't seen the show, obviously there will be a few spoilers. But while there is a plot, of course, the character-driven nature of the episodes mean there's not a lot to really spoil in the traditional sense, and I'll be sparing in talking about specific details. Of course, the solution to avoid getting spoiled is to just go and watch it, which I think everybody should. In the UK, it's on Prime, in Australia on Stan, and in America on Prime, Hulu, and Paramount Plus. Everyone else, you need to figure it out. So, if you enjoy coming-of-age stories, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe, etc., and follow me on Instagram and Facebook. You can also support the show on Patreon, where you'll get a monthly bonus episode. And this month, I'll be doing a commentary for the pilot episode of Freaks and Geeks, which, warning you, will probably just be me saying, okay, here's why this is great, over and over. Without further ado, let's talk about one of the greatest television shows ever made, Freaks and Geeks. The year is 1999. The top-rated television shows in America includes ER, Friends, The Practice, Frasier, Touched by an Angel, and of course, topping the list consistently, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? It's quite a fascinating little time capsule, before the dominance of reality shows would begin, and when the multi-camera sitcom reigned supreme. It's a mix of lighthearted comedy and earnest drama. While procedurals are still a solid bet, the worlds of Law & Order and NYPD Blue are still generally presented as one where the police are our heroes and working tirelessly to rid the world of evil. The earnestness and sincerity of The West Wing is gracing our screens every week. What is noticeable is the absence of shows about young people in this list. In the top 30 highest rated shows in the US for the 1999 to 2000 season, there is one that looks at the lives of teenagers, Malcolm in the Middle. While hilarious, insightful, and often very honest portrayal of adolescence, Malcolm was not exactly grounded in realism. While they may not have been in that top 30 list, other shows about teens were incredibly popular and critically acclaimed. There was a boom of it, in fact. In the late 90s, the WB was establishing itself and decided to court the teen market. By the time Freaks and Geeks premiered in 1999, we had Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Beverly Hills 90210, and of course, Dawson's Creek. Shows for and about young people might not ever make the top 10, because they are, by their very definition, niche, but their appeal to a teenage demographic is also their greatest strength. These shows are notable for featuring characters that appeal largely to young girls and their sense of wish fulfillment. Sure, there might be tragedy, but everyone was so beautiful and articulate and dramatic in the best possible way. These heightened, glamorous worlds were pure teen escapism, and we ate that up for good reason. Freaks and Geeks is not escapism. It is earnestly and brutally real. By design. The awkward moments are funny, yes, but they are also genuinely uncomfortable. The resolutions are not neat and tidy if they exist at all. The characters are not verbose and eloquent. The answers are not clear-cut. It's exactly like being a real teenager. No wonder no one wanted to watch it. Freaks and Geeks was not the first show that attempted to do this or have this kind of view, of course. My So-Called Life, starring Claire Danes, premiered in 1994. Similarly, it was praised by critics for its realism and grounded performances. Similarly, it was cancelled after only one season. Too much reality is often not what people want from their TV. We know that because reality television itself is the most heightened, out-of-step action you will find on our screen. Paul Feig himself identified this in retrospect, talking about the episode where Siegel's character Nick auditions for the drummer in a local band. It goes terribly, but not wacky, silly, absurdly terribly, realistically terribly. It is awkward and embarrassing and real. In an interview with the AV Club, Feig said, "It never felt dark to me, though, because I love the cringy comedy, because that's the stuff you relate to. I love laughing at stuff where you go, oh, that's happened to me, and it's so funny to see that. It just felt very real to me. The moment I realised we're in trouble, I was talking to one of the critics, and he'd watched that episode, and he goes, you know, Nick walks into that audition, and I just had to leave the room. I couldn't watch it. I was like, why? That's the funniest thing in the world to watch a guy tank an audition. I laugh because I'm cringing, but it's a different kind of cringing. It's like, oh, shit, I can't avert my eyes from it. I find it very funny, but I think part of it is I'm getting to play out things I went through. For me, it's cathartic. It's therapeutic." The episode in question is one of the defining ones of the series. But yeah, it's rough. And I can completely understand it being the sort of thing that would turn people away, particularly in the days where we used to casually watch television. Remember that? Ducking in and out and maybe not even watching anything from the beginning? I'm a big defender of that model of TV and think we've really lost something when streaming made binging the norm, but a show like Freaks and Geeks really benefits from the beginning to end build, which is probably why it's grown in esteem since people have begun to watch it that way. Its depiction of the teenage experience is not warm or sunny or even that optimistic, but it is earnest and heartfelt and above all very compassionate. Combined with the nuanced performances and not relying on big dramatic storylines or reveals, the one season we have of Freaks and Geeks has revealed itself to be a truly special thing. So let's start at the beginning, shall we? The year is 1998. Judd Apatow started out as a teenage stand-up comedian in the 80s before landing himself gigs writing for the 1991 Grammys and producing comedy specials for Jim Carrey and Tom Arnold, among others, and he also co-created The Ben Stiller Show. He went on to write for The Larry Sanders Show, The Critic, and the film Heavyweights. He produced The Cable Guy and apparently helped rewrite that script too, which I can't think of without remembering Homer Simpson ripping it to shreds in Planet Springfield. Apatow would continue to work on scripts for Carrey's movies and also work with his former roommate Adam Sandler on films like Happy Gilmore. He then created a sitcom about a psychiatrist starring David Krumholtz, but it was not picked up. And this led him to be the executive producer on Freaks and Geeks. He had a deal with DreamWorks Television and so was on the lookout for the next big good show. In the meantime, Paul Feig was also working as a stand-up in the 80s and 90s, playing small roles on TV, like My Beloved Sabrina. He also starred in Heavyweights. Apatow and Feig had met before this, however, in the stand-up scene throughout the 80s. In Vanity Fair's Oral History of Freaks and Geeks, Feig remembers how he saw the then 17-year-old Judd Apatow. "I would say this guy is really smart. Everybody should be nice to him because he could be running the town someday. He was the most mature 17-year-old I'd ever met in my life." Later, a couple of years after reconnecting on Heavyweights, Apatow mentions to Feig that if he ever has any ideas for television, they should get together. Apatow says, "I didn't think he would hand me a finished script a few months later, and I certainly didn't expect it to be the best thing I've ever worked on. That just never happens." And Paul Feig says, "I had just come off a year of trying to promote this movie I'd written, directed and produced and paid for, and I'd lost a good paying acting job before that on Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Everything had kind of hit the rocks. I was really at my lowest point. But I'd always wanted to write a high school show and seen so many where it was like, who are these people? I felt like they weren't honest at all. I kicked the thing out really fast. I think it had been gestating for so long in my brain. Cleaned it up and gave it to my wife. And she told me to send it to Judd. He called up about 12 hours after I sent him the script. He was like, I love this. I'm going to have DreamWorks buy it." The big teen shows I mentioned earlier, Dawson's Creek, Beverly Hills 90210, they're all good shows, but their criticisms have always been obvious. From the beginning, the characters from The Creek were scoffed at because of the way they talk. Teenagers don't talk like that. Of course, no one talks like people do on TV, and that's okay, they shouldn't. But there's definitely a gap, and while I personally watch those shows every now and then, my sensibility was much more locked into a show like Daria. That was where I felt at home, with its acknowledgement that being a teenager sucks and that the things that matter most are friendship and the adults that are often well-intentioned mostly seem stupid and out of touch. If I'd known about Freaks and Geeks when it came out, I would have been all over it. The show was almost immediately greenlit for these exact reasons. It was something different. I think they got very lucky with the people who read the script and immediately got what they were trying to do. They didn't want to mess with it and were happy to go along with Feig's desire, for example, to cast unknowns for the roles, real teenagers, not people in their 20s or stars who everyone already knew. The premise of the show is simple, but very effective. Set in 1980, our central character is 16-year-old Lindsay Weir. Lindsay Weir is intelligent, a high achiever, a good student who abides by the rules. And then her grandmother dies, and Lindsay is with her at the time. In those final moments, the young girl asks her beloved Nana if she can see a light, or God, or anything. And the answer is no. And this begins something in Lindsay. She starts wearing her dad's army jacket, ditching her extracurricular activities, and starts to branch out with new groups of people. The freaks. The ones who sit on the smoking patio, barely pass school, and smoke weed. We don't see any of this backstory. We just meet Lindsay in this crisis moment, with everyone asking what has gotten into her. In the pilot, we see her try to first connect with Daniel, Nick, and Ken, the freaks. It doesn't go super smooth. But it establishes the groundwork for everything that is to come. This is a girl who is hopelessly lost and looking for something radical to cling to. It's an idea that is immediately understandable and endearing. And then we have the geek centered around Lindsay's little brother, Sam. 14-year-old Sam Weir has two friends, Bill Havachuk and Neil Schweiber. These three like quoting Caddyshack, setting off rockets and playing D&D. They're in that crucial, weird transition between still kind of being kids, but being on the cusp of adulthood. They're dealing with bullies and crushes and figuring out who they want to be. And those are our starting pieces. Lindsay and Sam's parents also have a crucial role, as does Daniel's girlfriend, Kim Kelly. There's not much else to it other than these characters and other bit players we'll meet along the way. But that's all you need. The episodes throughout the season follow Lindsay and Sam and the Weir household, but everyone gets something to hang on to and at least a few episodes that really dig into their story, their background, their parents, and what makes them who they are. The essence of why this show is so good to me is compassion. There's no major villain or nemesis. The villain is ultimately the character's circumstances and sometimes their own personality. The story comes from what they do with that. Paul Feig says, "My friends and I weren't popular in high school and we weren't dating all the time and we were just trying to get through our lives. It was important to me to show that side. I wanted to leave a chronicle to make people who had gone through it laugh, but also as a primer for kids going in to say, here's what you can expect. It's horrifying, but all you should really care about is getting through it. Get your friends, have your support group, and learn to be able to laugh at it." It's evident from the get-go that this is a show that the people who made it really care about. Feig apparently had hundreds of pages of backstories for all of the characters. Some of it, though, particularly for the freaks, Feig admittedly did not relate to as much, were less fleshed out, so they decided to cast their actors and write for them once that was done. In comes Allison Jones, a name I think should be so much more well-known than it is. She's a casting director, and allow me to rattle off a few of the shows she has worked on. Family Ties, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Spin City, Parks and Recreation, The Office, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Veep, Arrested Development, The Good Place, Curb Your Enthusiasm. And movies? Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, Lady Bird, Booksmart, Barbie. That just scratches the surface. What strikes me most about this list is these are shows and films that rely on ensembles. They're not reliant on one big star to carry everything, even in the case of something like Barbie. They're about finding people who fit together, who are going to suit the voice of the project and connect with each other. Allison Jones is a goddamn genius. We start with casting Linda Cardellini as Lindsay, and Feig says he knew she was it as soon as she walked in. Director Jake Kasdan says, "We used to say in editing you could always cut to Linda, and she's doing the right thing." Cardellini you may know as Velma in the live-action Scooby-Doo movies, Chutney in Legally Blonde, and recently as Laura Barton in the Marvel Universe. The role of Sam, Lindsay's younger brother, would go to the then only 13-year-old John Francis Daly, who would go on to star in Bones, but has also really established himself as an excellent writer and director of comedies, being the guy behind Game Night, Horrible Bosses, and Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves. Daniel Desario, the rebel who was also just kind of a goof, his role went to James Franco. Nick Andopoulos, the underachiever pothead who just wants to play his drums, that goes to Jason Segel. Kasdan describes Segel as hilarious and endlessly charismatic. Yeah, pretty much. Ken Miller, the final of the trio of freaks, goes to 16-year-old Seth Rogen. Apatow immediately connects with Segel and Rogen, which you can see in how often they've worked together since then. Paul Feig has a great quote about Rogen. "Once we hired Seth," he said, "I was working with a drama coach. She was like, you've got to change your voice or you'll never get hired. And I was thinking, that's why I hate drama teachers." I'm a drama teacher. I'm guessing they're extra awful in the Hollywood context, but yeah, a lot of us really suck. Busy Phillips comes on as Kim's Kelly, Daniel's girlfriend. And then we have the geeks. Martin Starr, also only 16, is cast as Bill Havachuk, and Sam Levine is cast as Neil Schweiber. This entire cast has gone on to do some pretty incredible work. The team really found something special with this ensemble. And yes, I'm going to say a version of that sentence a lot. The fact that so many of this cast are actually teenagers, something that hadn't really been done, and were also unknowns, adds to that authenticity. But even now watching it and all of their faces being familiar doesn't take away from the energy of when it was first made. Every member of this cast is endearing, not only in their own performances, but in their connections and dynamics with each other. It's one of those shows you could pick any combination of characters and you'd have something unique and interesting happen. You match that with a writing team who really wanted to make something that felt true, and you're cooking. Feig says the writers locked themselves in a room and started with sharing personal stories. The best things that happened to them in high school, the worst things, their love stories, their drug stories, their embarrassing stories. And that's where a lot of it came from, the real stories. And all the writers credit Paul Feig with creating that atmosphere, but also for being willing to put so much of himself in the show. His worst moments became the best episodes. And that's what adds to the element of comfort this show becomes. Its ultimate message is, you're not alone. Awful things happen, and it sucks, but it doesn't make you a bad person, and it's going to be okay. Mike White, one of the writers, says, "I had done 2 years on Dawson's Creek and was trying to never do TV again. but I took a meeting with Shelley McCroy at NBC, and she pops in the pilot of Freaks and Geeks, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what I told them you could do on Dawson's Creek, but everyone had said you can't. The unmannered way that the characters spoke, and the idiosyncratic way they all looked. Jake Kasdan says, from the beginning, we thought that everything about the show should be painfully, painstakingly real. We were going to separate it from all the other high school shows by being radically unglamorous. This can be seen in not only what happens in the show and the performances, but also in how it's shot. The lighting, the camera, nothing is flashy or artsy. It's completely stripped back, focusing on the story and the characters. They really knew what they were doing. Though I will say, Linda Cardellini and Busy Phillips have also commented that it was kind of weird to have everyone talk about how unpretty and unglamorous this show was going to be. Not a great thing to hear as a young teenage female actress. So, the pilot is made. The show gets picked up. This incredible team is working on the season. The storylines range from crushes and awkward kisses to trying to start a band. The geeks deal with a bully. Neil finds out his dad is cheating. Lindsay has a car accident. There's parties and tests and watching porn and smoking weed. It's funny and it's heartfelt and it's all good stuff that's coming together. And then Garth Ancier becomes the new president of NBC, coming from his former job at the WB. Dan McDermott says, I remember getting the call that said, Garth doesn't get the show. He went to boarding school in Princeton. He doesn't understand public school. And that was the first flag that went up. They're given their time slot, Saturday at 8 p.m, premiering on September 25th, 1999. That's not a good time slot. The pilot did well, people tuned in, reviews were great. But the audience tuned out quickly. The funny thing is, they were doing so badly in the ratings, getting only about 7 million people a week. Nowadays, that's a huge hit. But hopes remained relatively high, I think. There was a conscious effort to try and improve the show and get more people watching, but some things made it difficult. One of which was James Franco. Now, I'm not going to get into and litigate all of the accusations that have been levelled at this man, but Busy Phillips has been very open about how Franco was. We know Apatow likes to let his actors improv, and that was definitely a technique adopted on this show to capture that realism, but Franco has allegedly taken it too far. Rogan recalls him throwing milk at someone's face. He would mess around a lot, and of course his interactions with Phillips often became physical. There's a reason the people on the show have only distanced themselves further from him as the years have gone on. Thankfully, the rest of the cast didn't use the quest for authenticity as an excuse to be a jerk and created some of the best moments on the show. The writers also started taking bigger risks and tackling bolder stories. Like I said, everyone cared. Siegel says, we would get the script on a Friday and Seth and James and I would get together at my house every Sunday without fail and do the scenes over and over and improve them and really think about them. We loved the show and we took the opportunity really, really seriously. Rogan backs this up by saying, we felt if we made the scenes better on the weekend, if we came in with better jokes, they would film it and they would. And we didn't know it at the time, but that was completely unindicative of probably every other show that was on television. So we have a show that has an emphasis on being honest and heartfelt, a cast that are talented and care about their work, and a network who does not get it. As the first season went on, it became clear this was going to be the only season. This is another element of TV that is disappearing, making it while it's still on, rather than making it all in a bubble and then dropping it all together. As is the concept of a time slot getting shoved around. The Saturday 8 p.m. time slot was bad enough, but NBC didn't even stick to that. They'd take it off air for weeks and put it back in a different place, or put it up against Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? One of my favourite quotes from the Vanity Fair oral history comes from Judd Apatow, who says, we started a website, but NBC refused to let us put the address on any of our ads because they didn't want people to know the internet existed. They were worried about losing viewers to it. The crew talks about the desperation of this time, begging for a full 22-episode order. A lot of them mention that the network wanted more wins for the characters, feeling like it was too depressing. Another mark against being too realistic. The victories the characters have, as director Jake Kasdan puts it, were the small ones, the little moments of joy in life. Those are not big TV selling points. There's no weddings or babies or even big dramatic breakups. It's quiet and it's small and it wasn't afraid of silences. That's not network television. Fig does say that a lot of the network was very supportive and wanted it to do well, and any of their notes were just trying to make it better. The show was officially cancelled on March 19th, 2000. The entire season hadn't even aired. A small handful of episodes were not seen in that first run. The cast and crew were devastated, if not surprised. And the show very well could have been lost to time, if not for the huge success of its creators and stars leading to new audiences discovering it, especially once streaming made it more accessible. Despite being set in the 80s and made in the 90s, Freaks and Geeks remains timeless in its quality. I've touched on a few things that make the show work so well already, and I'm keen to dive into those a little more. I mentioned that there's no clear-cut villain, and that every character is treated with empathy and like a well-rounded person, not just an obstacle. That's a big part of it for me. Like, in the beginning, it's clear that Harold and Jean Weir, Lindsay and Sam's parents, are set up to be foils of sorts, to the two of them, Lindsay in particular. And the pilot episode hammers this home, with Harold repeatedly telling Lindsay every wrong thing she does can result in death, from skiffing school to having premarital sex. It's all played mostly for laughs, good ones, with the parents bordering on caricatures of grown-ups who just don't understand. As the show unfolds, however, the nuances to their relationships are revealed, not only with their kids, but also with each other. They're also placed in stark contrast with the families of the other characters. This really comes into play in the episode Smooching and Mooching. After a bad report card, Nick's militant father sells his beloved drum kit, so he leaves, and somehow ends up crashing on Lindsay's couch. Harold plays him some jazz, connects him with a drum teacher, and generally offers him some guidance. When Lindsay expresses her discomfort and asks why her dad is being nicer to Nick than he is to her, he tells her he understands what it's like to have a tough father. Lindsay says she does too, and Harold says, "No, you don't." And it's true. Harold and Jean are tough on Lindsay, sure, but they are woefully disconnected from where she's at. But they also care. It reminds me a lot of Lady Bird and the question that gets posed there. Isn't love and attention the same thing? Lindsay has her parents' attention in ways her friends do not, and that only becomes more obvious as the series continues. Kim Kelly is another example of a character initially set up as a nemesis of sorts to Lindsay. She's mean and openly dislikes her, but only four episodes in we come to the episode Kim Kelly is My Friend. Kim invites Lindsay over, seemingly to be nice, but eventually it's revealed she wants to show her mother she has a good friend, so they won't sell her car. It's clear instantly that Kim's home life is unbelievably difficult, full of that terrible combination of abuse and neglect. It's a huge turning point for the series, not only as it's the beginning of Lindsay and Kim becoming actual friends, but also for the audience. Up until this point, Kim's been a point of conflict to overcome, but by the end, she's a person you understand. The unfortunate thing is, this episode was one of the ones that did not originally air. Even Paul Feig talks about how he was concerned about how rough it was, and by this point the show was already hemorrhaging viewers, so it seems like the network got scared. What you miss, of course, is this crucial moment in Lindsay and Kim's relationship. It's a begrudging friendship that builds slowly into mutual understanding, respect, and genuine care. Another crucial episode for their friendship, and the show in general, as it is reflective of the show's tendency to let the characters grow and change in their understanding of each other and themselves, is the episode Looks and Books. After the freaks pressure Lindsay into taking her dad's car to pick up some equipment, she has an accident with someone pulling out of their driveway. By the way, maybe road rules are different in America, but in Australia, that is 100% the driveway person's fault. Anyway, Lindsay's parents are furious, and she is mortified, and it leads her to another crisis where she seems to realise that her freak friends are leading her down a bad path. She ditches her jacket, she rejoins the mathletes, only to realise she doesn't fit in there anymore either. It's such an important episode for everyone, because at the start, Lindsay seemed like a hanger-on with the freaks, but it's this one where we realise she matters to them too. Her opinion of them matters, and they care about her. Kim, Daniel, and Ken all show up to her mathlete final and cheer when she does well, even though they have no idea what's going on. It's a real sign of everyone's connections deepening, and Lindsay realizing she still doesn't have it all figured out, but she knows where she wants to be right now. I love that episode. Another one of Lindsay's key relationships that's allowed to really grow and develop and reflect the complexity of teen romance and sexuality is her connection with Nick. Initially, Daniel was set up to be her love interest, and while Lindsay's crush is still there, it's kind of petered out by the fifth episode, Tests and Breasts. Fig talks about how her dynamic with Nick was so much more interesting, with this guy who's clearly a sweetheart and so keen, but kind of going nowhere. I'm with the Band is an episode I talked about earlier, and it's one of the finest, even if it does contain a scene that exemplifies maybe why the show initially failed. Nick Andopoulos is a really tragic figure to me, and this starts to become apparent in this episode. He's shown Lindsay his big, gigantic drum kit in the pilot and established that that is his passion, and it's really explored in I'm with the Band. Of course the guys are in a band, as so many teenage boys who can play guitar sort of are, but not only is Nick the only one who really cares about it, he's also the one who really feels like there's stakes involved. He's not doing well in school, and like I've mentioned, his father is a military man and a total hard ass who doesn't understand his son at all. He's got the threat of being sent to military school hanging over his head, limits on when he can practice, and a general sense that his dreams are not going to be fulfilled. Lindsay's approach to Nick in this episode is genuinely sweet. She wants to see him succeed. She encourages him to get the band to practice more and take it more seriously. She finds the audition with the local band Dimension. She is hopeful in her advice, literally telling him he can do anything he puts his mind to. But that's not reality for everyone. Lindsay's privilege as not only being a child of supportive parents, but also one who has innate smarts and doesn't really have to work that much hard to do well, and literally could do anything she put her mind to, that privilege is really on show here. The naive nature of her advice comes crashing to a head during the audition. Sometimes dreams outpace abilities, and that's another big part of growing up. And in the horrible aftermath of that audition, where Nick is feeling just at his lowest, Lindsay kisses him, in a clear example of her just wanting to fix things and have the answers. I'm not going to go into all the details of Nick and Lindsay's relationship, as it's much better to see it play out and my explanation can't do it justice, but it's not smooth. It's not easy. It's not filled with drama either. It's the all too common experience of two teenagers getting together and one of them being way more into it than the other. It also reflects Fig's approach to exploring teenage sexuality. He says, "I really wanted the show to be about the fear of sex. I got tired of every teenager being portrayed as horny and completely cool with sex because that's not my experience." Yeah. This is also seen in the Tests and Breasts episode, where Sam sees a porno for the first time and is horrified rather than turned on. Everyone really does develop in their own timeline, and smooth and sexy is not what most teenagers are. The show's approach to romance and their love lives is always nuanced and allows the characters to change their mind, learn more about themselves and what they want. Sam's crush on cheerleader Cindy Sanders is a running thread throughout the series, and it's a brilliant move that when they finally do go out, he realizes he doesn't like her all that much. Sure, she's pretty, but they also have nothing in common, and she's more sexually advanced than he is. His absolute terror when she tries to give him a hickey when he just wants to watch the jerk is an all-time moment for the show. And it all leads to maybe my favourite scene, or at least one of them. There are many contenders. Seth Rogen's character Ken doesn't get a lot of main storylines, but his budding romance with Amy, aka Tuba Girl, is a highlight, especially as it shows where Fig and Apatow were willing to go. It's with her that Ken reveals his parents are actually very well off, but completely absent in his life, and he was largely raised by a nanny. Background to the character that instantly makes him more interesting. In that same conversation, Amy reveals she was born intersex, which sends Ken down a bit of a spiral as he tries to figure out what that means for him. There's a lot of humour to be milked from it, but also a lot of heart. And when you read the creators' descriptions of how they came to this, they did initially think this would be funny and a bit of a joke. But then Feig says, no, what if we tried to tackle this honestly? And it works. While Ken's in crisis, thinking he might have to break up with Amy, he runs into Sam. I mentioned earlier that this is a show that can throw any characters together and find something interesting, and this is a perfect example. Sam is about to break up with Cindy, and he lists all the reasons why. She hated the jerk. They have nothing to talk about. They have nothing in common. And Ken has this lovely moment of realization that his girlfriend is wonderful, and she loved the jerk, and he loves her, and that's what matters. It's the kind of television moment that gives me chills just thinking about it. Honestly, I could go on and on like this. There's so many parts of this show, both big and small, that just feel special. Daniel and Harris connecting for the first time, Bill saying he'll eat anything for a dollar, the entire storyline with Neil finding out about his dad's infidelity. And then beyond storylines, there's little moments. It's a show that wasn't afraid of being quiet or taking its time. There's a whole wordless scene where Bill is eating grilled cheese, watching television, and laughing entirely alone. And it's so perfect. It could easily be cut, but it's an episode that digs into the dynamic of being an only child with a single mother. And so it feels important, even though it's small. It's quite remarkable how much they were able to cover in just 18 episodes. Characters reinvent themselves. They meet new people. They discover new things. Some of it lasts, some of it doesn't. Just like being a teenager. It's all still television, of course. But my main takeaway in doing this research and reflection is that what makes Freaks and Geeks great was also its downfall. That unflinching authenticity in its exploration of the teen experience. There's moments that are genuinely touching and moving and even devastating. But it also manages to be completely hilarious. The characters are treated with sympathy and compassion, while also highlighting how much they make mistakes and are sometimes completely absurd. This show is all about growing up, that messy, complicated, difficult process that doesn't have a set start or end point. And it's a time period that we don't really see clearly until we're many years out of it and realize that everything was going to be okay. There's something so crucial about these young adolescent years, and I see it every day in my work as a high school teacher, but you can also see it in people when they talk about their own life at that stage. Shows and books and movies can never fully capture what that was like. But I remember showing Freaks and Geeks to my mother, who was 16 in 1980 when the show is set. Kim Kelly appeared and she said, "Oh my God, I know that girl. There was a girl exactly like that at my school. Right down to the jacket." There's something about those moments. When you're young, especially, but this can come with you into adulthood, it can be so easy to feel like you're the only one having an experience or going through something. Everyone else has it figured out and fits in, except you. And it's so important to have things that exist that tell you you're not alone and that you're seen. That's Freaks and Geeks at its absolute best. It's also just damn good television, with sharp, articulate, witty writing, charismatic, endearing performances, and that desire to do something a little different. The attempt may not have paid off at the time, but I know how much the show means to me personally, not to mention countless others. Its legacy and reputation, I believe, will only grow. Technology and fashion and attitudes may change, but that universality of the teen experience is something we can all tap into from time to time. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you'd like to hear my commentary over the pilot episode of Freaks and Geeks, you can subscribe to my Patreon. Link is in the description of this episode, or you can go to wildanddarling.com.au. That's wild with an E. Join me next month for my December episode, one I've been wanting to do since I started this show. I'm going to be talking about Elf on the Shelf, a Christmas tradition that's been around since the days of 2005. I'm going to research its origin, its rise in popularity, and explore whether this thing is good for kids or not. So you'll hear from me then, and in the meantime, I think I'm going to be rewatching Freaks and Geeks. Take care of yourselves.